alongside my wife, I run Machine Age Productions. We are an indie publisher of quality games, or at least that's what our mothers think. And we have a fan now. No, I wanted to go over a little bit about the logistics of what it takes to publish a game, kind of go over the real way that things go, as opposed to some of the beliefs that I've heard people have. I've worked in freelance and development for White Wolf, Catalyst, Paizo, Green Ronin, lots of the major publishers out there. Pretty much, if it's a pretty well-known RPG, I've probably worked on it or have good friends with someone who did. Small community gaming is. So, as I said, I'll talk a little bit about the logistics, and then I want to more or less do a little bit of discussion, see if you guys have any questions, because I can lecture, I can go over crap like that all day, but really, that's not gonna do anything but tell you those little anecdotes that I have. I would prefer to sort of address your specific concerns and curiosities. How many of you guys are actually, like, either trying to publish a game or interested in doing so in the future? Just show up hands real quick. Okay, good. So that's a majority of you. How many have actively, like, actually published a game? Cool.
Define published.
Yeah. Published, well, in this sense, I would say, develop a project from start to finish and put it up for public consumption. I mean, like, that real abstract terms here is really, it's not a lot different than publishing for something for sale. I know you've been in the process for a long time.
Right.
I talked
Game Chef, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Game Chef is and that sort of thing. Whenever you're just doing it alone, it's a little different. Whenever you're developing with a crew, that's when the real sort of logistics questions come into play. You might want to get that checked out. Sorry. I'm going to start with a little bit with just the basic development process. Let me preface that. When I say the development process, I mostly mean for small to mid publishers, because, again, we're talking about indie publishing here. The process itself, from start to finish. I once had it described to me by a friend of mine that publishing a game is very similar to birthing a child. No, denigration meant to the women who have done so, because you've obviously done a lot more than I have. But it takes a very long time. It's a very big process, and there's a lot of considerations that have to go into it. I think the quickest game that I've ever seen published was about 9 months. So that's the short end of that analogy. The long end, I've seen games take about 3 years until they hit the shelves. Usually, if it takes more than about a year and a half to 2 years, it's not going to come out. Then if they do later, you know, you can point to it and say, oh, crap, I developed that. If you were developing in a crew, this is RPGs. Like, nobody works in an office anymore. If you want to work in an office and you actually want to have coworkers per se in the RPG industry, you basically need to work for Wizards of the Coast. There are a couple of companies that have small offices, but for the most part, we all work from home. We all commute via the internet. Twitter and Facebook are our water cooler, basically, and that's how we keep appraised of the events and affairs that are happening in the industry. So, if you are developing a game, usually you have to sort of build a virtual office. You have to get together the people that you want to get, and you have to consider it a professional environment, whatever you're doing. I personally, actually one of our artists, our cover artist for our most recent game is back there, Jenna Fowler. She understands my sort of virtual office philosophy. I use Skype, and we have a Skype chat that is open that we could leave messages back and forth for the entire crew. Even if the crew members are not working on the specific part of the product that we are talking about, I like them to be involved in the discussion. I like them to understand, because really we're building a cohesive whole. I am sure that every single one of you who has read RPGs has read an RPG that did not feel like a cohesive whole. where the art disconnected with the writing, or the development disconnected with the writing, the fluff versus the crunch, that sort of thing. In order to build something that is cohesive, that does communicate one single message, you really have to have a group of people that are brought together, and they're all involved in a mutual conversation. It is not a coincidence that I consider RPGs themselves a conversation. That's what we do. It's campfire stories with dice, basically. So in order to facilitate that, we really need to build that from the front end. If you're not having a conversation with your crew, your players are not going to have a conversation at the table. That has to be followed through from the beginning to the end. So if you're developing an indie RPG, an RPG in general, first thing you got to do is you got to figure out what the hell you're doing. So a mission statement is usually enough, because if the more development work you do before you start bringing people in, the more that it's going to get torn apart. Again, analogy for a game itself, if you've ever planned a game and then watched your players run roughshod over it, but still had a fun time, that's not dissimilar from developing an RPG. If you bring a detailed, complex outline to the table, and you have all of this vision, all of these ideas, they're not going to survive. You could look at your design document, and then you look at the final product, and you wonder how the hell you got there. And that's going to have a lack of clarity and vision. You're going to have that problem. If your design document doesn't look like the end product, you might have a cool product, but again, you're not going to be communicating that message, so it's going to fall apart at the table. When I look to the crew that I am going to hire for a design document, I put together maybe 3 pages. This is what I want to do. This is the things I want to communicate. This is the process I want to get there. That's it. Then I start looking at the talent. The reason I hire talent is not because I have a glut of money sitting around that I want to just throw at people. It's because I want to bring their skills to the table. I want them to shine. If I did not want that, I would just write the thing myself, which is a huge bit of labor. But really, if you're going to hire someone, you're hiring their specific abilities. You're hiring the things that you cannot do that they can. Because if you bring those people together, you bring that talent to the table, then what you're going to have is a product in the end that is a conglomeration of all of these unique talents. There is a sort of axiom in freelancing and in development that you can be you can be 2 of 3 things. You cannot be all 3, or at least most people cannot. And those things are friendly, fast, and affordable. Friendly also goes together with quality to an extent, because you'll find that if someone is not bringing quality to the table, you are also not going to be friendly with them. Sometimes you can find all 3. If you find those 3, basically you keep them around and you worry yourself not to run them haggard. But if you get 2 of those 3 things, stick with them. If you find someone that can consistently hit deadlines and do it within your budget, love that person. Let them know how much you appreciate them. Let them know, just what value they're bringing to your product. Freelancers, any creative people in the world, they're going to be prima donnas to an extent. We all have our insecurities. Whenever I write something and I know that, it's not going to come out until next year, I'm going to worry the hell out of that product. I'm going to think about it. I'm going to be like, I would have done this differently. I'm such a hack. It's so terrible. I'm going to get panned on RPGNet. And honestly, we need a little reassurance. If you are working in a development crew, you have to have positive reinforcement. Sure, you have to criticize. You have to give the necessary constructive criticism to make the product better. You have to push people in order to achieve and succeed. But you have to remember to be positive. Even if someone brings it to the table that, I'm sorry, I can't hit the deadline. I know you have to print next week, but I need 2 weeks. It's just not something that I can do right now. No amount of bitching at them is going to change that. Sometimes you can harangue someone into tightening that deadline or fixing the problem, but usually whenever someone gets to the point where they're actually saying, Mr. Developer, I can't accomplish this goal you need. These are the terms that I need to accomplish them on. You can, A, complain at them. Hope that they'll fix it. Hope that the universe will shift and that their mother will mysteriously come back from the dead and they don't need to go to a funeral or whatever. You can be, yeah, I've tried it, it doesn't work. If you take anything out of that, that's it. You can't bring their mothers back from the dead so they don't have to go to the funeral.
Do zombies count?
It depends. I mean, if they're a zombie, they probably had a funeral. That's a whole level of complexity. That's like InDesign 202. And the B, what you could do is you could let the project fall to shit. Unacceptable. Usually by that point, you have other people that are writing on this project and they're invested in it. They want their work to be seen, and you have a product that has other stuff going on. You really need to get it done. You can C, drop them and go with someone else. 9 times out of 10, that is a very bad idea. I've had to do it before. It sucks because whenever you're sitting 2 weeks after a deadline and you can't get a guy to answer his email about some art, and then you have to tell people, oh, I need some art tomorrow. Can you do some art tomorrow for me? that's hard, but it is a fact of the industry. It's very difficult to get people to commit 100% to things. We're making pretend time games. Nobody's making a killing off of these things. Even the richest names in the industry. So you have to understand that nobody does this as their primary job, except for me and I'm poor. So accommodate. That's the best thing that you can do. Accommodate. Be positive. Understand. Talk to them. Communication. Communication is essential to every step of the process. If you are not in communication, you will fall short. I don't know how people did it in the 80s. I don't know how people did it before the internet, honestly. I guess they just did it in their parents' basements, and they have their development crew all living there, too. I don't know. Before the internet, no idea how development happened. Fortunately, I'm younger than that. So keep in communication. Accommodate these people. Understand that they are real people. Understand that, for the most part, if you work with someone, if you respect them, if you believe that they are doing things with the same passion and the same enthusiasm that you are, that they're not going to come and tell you that they can't do it because they don't want to, or that they're being prissy. They're telling you this because they've exhausted every other option. I know when I'm writing for a developer and I tell them I need 2 more days on my deadline, that's not, I can use 2 more days. No, that's, something blew up and it's going to take 2 days to repair. Until then, I can't eat. Or something. I believe people. Sort of trust in the fundamental good nature of people. There will be some people that will screw you over in that regards, but it happens. RPGs, exercise in trust. That conversation that you have at the table. If you do not have trust with your GM, with your fellow players, the game won't work. Same thing on the front end. You're basically just playing a game. It's just a little bit more boring and doesn't make as much money if you're developing. That's the people. You find the talent, you trust them, you communicate with them, you work with them. Now the actual process, once you have the people in place. There's an often touted myth in RPGs that if you are working in the development of games, that you always have a project going on, and that as long as a project is in development, you are working on it. That is complete bullocks. If a project takes 2 years, it is not because the writers took 2 years to write it. Usually it means the writers took 6 months at most. How many of you have written a novel? A couple of you. Okay, so an RPG book, if you're going for a moderate-sized book, D&D, 3rd edition, 4th edition, those are pushing 200 to 3,000 words. 300,000. 200,000 to 300,000 words. Your average novel is 80,000. Which is to say that your average core RPG book clocks out at about 3 to 4 times a novel. Technically, you can write a novel in a month. A lot of people do it. There are little contests on the internet where people write 50,000-word novellas in a month. They're crap. They don't work. They have to be edited. They have to be basically torn apart, thrown away, and completely rewritten. If you write 50,000 words in a month, you are basically a machine, or you're throwing crap at the wall and seeing what sticks. So, by that logic, you got a 300,000-word RPG. 50,000 words, if you're busting ass and you're making crap product, you can do it in a month. That is to say, if one person is doing an RPG, 6 months, and if they work constantly for 6 months, they have a crap product. And that's just the very basics of that. If you have two people, then that's 3 months to make a crap product on the writing side. RPG words take a lot longer than fiction words because you have to test them. You have to throw them at the wall and see what sticks. And what sticks, that's maybe 5% of it. That ends up going in the book. Then you got to go back to the drawing board. You got to throw more crap at the wall, see what sticks. You got to keep doing it until eventually you have enough to really have a coherent product. That can take a very, very long time. If you have a strong staff that is dedicated and that is communicating, 50,000 words in a month, I think when we've had 4 or 5 people working on a project, we could push out 50 to 100,000, and it's good. If you're working together and you are really, really dedicated to the grind of the product, you can do it. That's an exception, not the rule. That's writing. Writing can take up to 6 months. That is just the reality of it. I would say cut that in half for your average supplements, because supplemental material typically doesn't take as much testing. You're not actually developing as much. You're just sort of adding to something. So that's a little bit easier. But core material, expect 6 months for a solid game. If you have a crew of people that is dedicated, if you're doing it alone, a year. My advice, if you're doing that, if you're trying to write a game by yourself or with just one person with you, write it, hammer it out, just do the whole damn thing. Tear it apart and do it again. That's really your only hope. And it's so sad, because whenever you get to the end of that product, you're like, I just cranked out 300,000 words. Then you realize you got to scrap 250,000 of it. That was 5 months of my last 6. And it's not wasted work. That's the difference between game design and like novel writing, is that in game design, you throw away a lot. And almost none of it is wasted. Because everything that you threw away was something that didn't work. And in a game, stuff that didn't work, it's very valuable. I'm sure you've all played games where you found something that didn't work and you wish that it would have been cut. Another common myth, we would love to cut stuff. We would love to change stuff a lot more than we are able to. Once you get to a certain point, though, and you have to pay the electric, you can't really turn around. If you're 300,000 words in, you're about done with that product, and you're on a tight development schedule, you can't go back and retroactively change things, particularly because in a game, if you change something at the beginning of the book, you fundamentally change the rest of the book. And you have to acknowledge as a game designer that you are going to have flawed material. There is nothing perfect, period. As a player, once you've designed, you look at things a lot differently. As a player, you tear apart what you were reading, and you're like, I can see where they could have done this differently, but I understand why they did it the way they did. I understand why they couldn't change it. So, first part of the process, writing. You've got your core development material. You cannot start editing until you are done. Editing takes about half as much time as writing. So, say you take 6 months editing, expect 3. And that's being very nice. Because if you have a good editor, you'll probably be doing a lot of rewrites too. Quick curiosity here. What's an editor? Someone show hands. What's an editor? What do they do? What do they do?
Developmental editor, copy editor, line editor.
That's the correct answer.
All of the above.
So, I've written a lot for White Wolf. Any of you who have paid attention to their books, there are typos. There are a lot of typos. There are page XX references. And all the time on the internet, people are like, they need to, they're literally Hitler. Hitler also made typos. And that their editor needs to burn, die in a fire, whatever it is that they say on the internet these days. And every time, I want to shake them and explain to them that that's not the editor's fault, really. For one, a writer should be going through and looking through their material and trying to cut out all the typos and the glaring grammatical errors. That's hard. As a writer, particularly in a game setting, I'm just trying to make the game work. I do go through and I do edit my work. I pay attention to little squiggly lines in Microsoft Word, but it doesn't always work that way. It doesn't always get through. A good editor in an RPG book is really someone who is trying to make your message readable and digestible. So it doesn't matter as much if you use the correct usage of the word there as it does that you are able to properly convey what your players need to be doing. Because you're writing an instruction manual. Clarity and the coherence of your vision are the most important things an editor can look for. It's so hard to find an editor that knows this. And you can even tell people, they're like, oh no, I've done editing work in college. Well, you line edited. We don't really need that. That's not that important. Like you can do that whenever you're going through it, but that's a passing glance. That's like saying that I'm a pizza chef. I make pieces of dough that have sauce and cheese on them. Well, you're not really a pizza chef. You do make pizzas, but they're just not any good. There's a lot more to it. So there's 9 months right there. Art cannot happen until writing is pretty much done. I'm sure all of you have seen games where the art was probably done at the beginning of the process. They were assigning art at the beginning, and you look at it and you're like, I don't know that there are flaming ponies in this book. I don't know why they have a flaming pony picture. But lo and behold, they do. It's probably because they found it on a stock art site where they said, well, I think we're going to have flaming ponies in this book, so why don't we assign someone to do them? And then they do them, and then later on, they retcon and they change the flaming ponies out because they're not that cool. And so then they have the art. It's done. It's paid for. And they have to put it somewhere. So lo and behold, you got flaming ponies in your book. You'll get that a lot in RPGs because of the way that a development schedule works, because a lot of developers think that they can do everything congruently, that art can be done at the same time as development, as editing, as writing. Yeah. So you stagger. You're writing and you have editing. Right around about halfway through the writing, you can start art. I wouldn't start it any earlier than that because so much stuff can change in later writing and in editing. So keep it simple. A lot of developers like to do cover art early because they can use it in promotional material, and I can certainly see the value in that, but I've never once seen a game where that was done, where the game was not structured later in such a way that it invalidated the cover. How many times have you played a game where the cover, you're like, that's some elves on motorcycles, and this is totally a game about wizards. There's a disconnect. The cover can look cool, but it doesn't really communicate anything. That's not going to be very helpful. So I say, I do cover art last. That's my way of doing it. So, writing, editing, art. Once you've got a little bit of art in, and once you've got the initial edits in, then you can start layout. Layout is a very tricky monkey because every bit of edits that you do has to reflect in the layout. And the layout ends up being where you get things like your page XX references, your indices, those sorts of things. They're impossible to do until the very end. If you try to have someone doing layout while you are writing, things will change. And when you have a 200-page book and you change something on page 4, you now have 196 pages of layout that you've got to fix. Your layout person will explode. If they do not kill you first. And they will have all right in the world to do so. Layout is very laborious. There are parts of it that are fun, but it can be, good layout is hard work. It is labor. And you can't just tell someone, just fix those 196 pages. It doesn't really work that way. InDesign is a pretty intuitive program, but not that intuitive. Not enough to make up for, human love and attention.
How do you do that to work?
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I would die. This is purely very modern speaking, very much we use InDesign. I feel for anyone that has ever done layout in Quark or in Microsoft Word.
Word perfect.
Yeah.
I know someone.
Oh, terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. It didn't work.
It's harsh.
Yeah.
It's really, really a nightmare. I would never wish it on my enemies.
What do you use?
I use InDesign. I've been learning to do InDesign because I have a layout guy that does most of my core books, but my supplement books we're sort of developing while he's doing layout. So the way that our development schedule is staggered, I have to end up doing layout for supplement work. And InDesign is really great. I can't speak enough praise of it. I love it. And I'm not even a design-minded guy. It kind of makes me look like I am, which is, I guess, the software's job. And so that's the basic part of the development cycle. Really, you have other steps, like you have other parts of the process, printing, which I'll get into in a moment because that's a little bit more complicated, but printing takes a little bit. Marketing. Marketing really shouldn't start until 6 months before your product comes out. Also, it should never start until at least halfway through your process, at very least. There is an argument to start marketing early. If you start too early, you run the risk of oversaturating. You are bombarding people with messages, and they're like, cool, cool, cool. By the time the product comes out, you're like, oh. All the time, I get this with movies and video games. The new Elder Scrolls game, I've been hearing about it for 2 years, and they've had a release date for 2 years. By the time it comes out, I'm going to forget that it was coming out. And I probably won't get it on release day because I've just been bombarded. If they would have gotten me while I was excited, I would have bought it. But I've long since passed that point. So that's the basic process. That's it. 9 months to a year and a half is a good goal, is a good expectation to have. Keep in mind, you don't really start writing per se until you have the game, until you have a pretty good idea of what you're writing. That can take a while. Some people do that for years. If you're trying to pay the bills, you can't. You really got to do that initial playtest idea in about a month to three if you're really trying to keep on a good development cycle. Okay, next thing, printing. Printing is the bane of publishers everywhere. For example, I just printed a book, and it is a 212-page, full-color, hardcover book. You can get books out there, right now you can go on the sales floor and you can find some hardcover, full-color books that are $35, and the reason is because of really big discounts. Printers are able to do that. The basis of comparison, though, my book that we just released, it costs $27 per copy to print because I don't have a very, very big print run. If I am printing up to 999 of them, they're going to cost me $27 a piece. If I print 1,000, they cost me $9 each. I am not shitting you. I shopped around for these numbers. Once you hit 1,000, that's sort of a sweet spot for colored print. And we're talking like, that's shipping my work to Thailand. My books currently, the ones that I'm paying $27 a copy for, they are being printed in the U.S. That is, I guess 1,000 is really where it starts to become viable to do it overseas. And that's what a lot of even digital printers do. Yes.
So it sounds like 300 is when it becomes really viable to do it overseas, because that's when you're paying the same amount as 1,000.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're printing 3,000 or 300, you might as well print 1,000.
If you've got space to.
Yes,
yes and no. If you're printing that many, you probably should already have a plan in mind for that. Distribution is a funny monkey. That's actually the next part of what I'm going to talk about. So $27 versus $9 once you hit that sweet spot. And you have this gap. You have 300 books or you have 1,000 books. And 1,000 books is very big. Believe you me, I had 100 that I was sort of dragging around town to get to the dealer's hall, and they're very heavy. At 3 pounds each, that gets pretty big. Whenever you have 300, that's 3 times that. It's really terrible. But okay, so the 27. My initial projection was 22. That's what the printer told me. The reason is because I was printing a 200-page book. 200 pages is $22, $23, and 12 more pages is like $5 extra a copy. Where's the disconnect? That's a good question. If you ask the printer, they will basically tell you, we have numbers and stuff. There are algorithms. It is, yes, that is basically it. They kill the chicken, and the chicken blood tells them how much it costs to print. And whenever you are budgeted for about 200 pages, and your layout guy comes out with a 230-page book, like, we can't do that. That will kill our budget. And then you carve it, you cut it, and you do everything you can, and you end up with a 212-page book, and it's 27, and you can't cut any more. There's really nothing you can do, and you just break the bank. Whenever you're printing 250 copies, that $5 becomes a pretty big chunk of money for a budget of otherwise like $2,000-$3,000. It almost like it adds about 25% to it. It's terrible, and that's the sort of thing that you have to expect. From whenever you're doing small press work. And that's like digital print on demand and pretty much the cheapest out there. If you go through a lot of people nowadays do like Lulu. That's a common one for RPG publishers. If I were to print that book in Lulu, it would be $75 per copy. Now, here's another magic number. If you were going through traditional distribution channels, a good publisher will expect to buy their books or their prints at 20 to 25% of the total cost that they expect to charge people. So if you are paying $75 for a book, then you should be expecting to charge your customers $300. How do you get to college? You ever cried about the price of books? That's why. Because it costs a lot of fucking money to print books. And it's not the publishers, it's not the writers, it's not the school. It ultimately comes down to print and distribution. So 20 to 25% is what you should expect to be paying for your books. The reason is, and this saddens me every time I drop a tear, distribution. Walmart. Everyone has probably heard that Walmart is oftentimes accosted for being terrible for content creators and for distributors and that sort of thing. Walmart asks you to sell them your product at 50% of your retail price. So if I'm selling a product for $20, they want it for $10. If I am buying my product from the printer for 20 to 25%, that's like $5. So I'm making $5 a copy off of the $20 book. Walmart's making 10. So I'm busting my ass and doing all of this work. Walmart's making twice as much as me. Yeah.
And for board games, distributors want it for about 60% off.
Retailers want it for 50% off. See, that's where the Walmart analogy comes in. Walmart wants 50%. Comic book, game, and board game distributors, they want between 60 and 70. If you're an untested publisher, they want you to sell at 70% off of retail. So, in the situation that I am selling, say, a book for $50, they're going to want, like, they're going to want to sell them for like $15-$20 at very, very best. And that's if I've negotiated with them. My books cost $27 to print. I would be losing about $10 to $20 off of every copy. Why would anyone do that?
You can't. Wonder why brick and mortar stores are going away.
Exactly.
And they wonder why I give a shit that brick and mortar stores are going away.
Exactly. It's terrible. I remember I was really excited with my first book that we were buying them for about $5 a piece. They're soft covers. We were buying them for about $5 a piece, and I was like, wow, you know, if I sell these for $25, then I'm gonna make, you know, quite a bit of profit through direct sales. And you can't undercut stores. If you sell your book for $25 at a store, if you sell it for $20, they're gonna be mad. And they rightfully so, because you're undercutting them. You're telling people that you could go to the store and pay $25, or you just buy it from me for $20. I would make more money that way. And people will do it. People will be like, oh yeah, I would love to buy it for $20 and make you more money. Of course they will. But you're undercutting the store. And that is visibility, that is accessibility that you don't otherwise have. So I buy my book for $5, I want to sell it for $25, and the distributors are wanting it for $10. And ultimately, it's sort of a weird disconnect that I have put in all of the work. I have spent a year of my life, and they are making more money off of that than I am.
But you can market your book on your website, sell it at the same cover price, and you're not undercutting anybody.
Exactly. As long as you're doing it for the same price, then you're not undercutting everyone,
but
and that's
making more profit.
Yeah, and that's ultimately what I do. Because I'm an indie publisher, I like to approach things. Every book is different. Every book needs a different amount of love. I can do traditional distribution for some books. I can't for others. I do direct sales. I do convention sales and stuff. When I sell at a convention, same book, same analogy, $27 for a copy, I sell it for $50. So that looks like $23. $23, but a booth is about $1,300 at Gen Con. So right there, you're looking at, you know, 50, 60 copies that you have to sell just to cover your booth costs.
Right.
Airfare. Food.
Hotel.
Cab.
You got to hump a lot of books to read them.
A lot. And then once you hit that point, and you're like, I've sold 300 books, and I'm starting to recoup my losses. I've broken even. Every book from here out is profit. And then it's Sunday, and some guy's like, can I get it at a discount because it's Sunday? And you're like, yes, please, give me money. I need to eat. That's the reality of that. So direct sales, you do make more money, but also you're putting money into marketing. You are really having to communicate to these people. You have to be out there. My time is valuable. And so when I am advertising, when I'm pushing things, when I'm at conventions, this weekend I can't write. I work 7 days a week. I write 7 days a week. I bust ass on these games. And when I have to take 6 days off to go to Gen Con, that's 6 days that I can't be writing. So that's an even bigger cost. It's an abstract cost, but it's most certainly a cost.
That kind of like that. Now, with that shrinking margin, how do you go back and budget for the talent? I mean, how do you know the talent budget?
It's very difficult, honestly.
It's not just paying you. You've got to pay. You have to pay in advance. Paid all those other costs.
Well, the one thing that you do, whenever you're publishing indie, is a little bit different than whenever you're publishing through a traditional house. The first thing that you have to remember is that you aren't paying yourself. You might end up paying yourself, but you do not budget to pay yourself. I never budget to pay myself whenever I develop a book. Because that's just going to eat out of my budget, basically. That's going to be, it's honestly a made up number, kind of, whenever you try to budget for yourself. So I don't do it. I budget for my talent. It's very, very hard. You have to look at what you expect to sell, and you basically have to roll the dice on that. You have to look at your initial funding. I, for example, a lot of people have recently been using like Kickstarter and other crowdsourcing programs. I used it for Amaranthine, the most recent book that I did, and that helped me determine what my budget was going to be. But again, things will change. You will get, you know, that extra 12 pages that is going to cost you that extra bit of money. Budgeting, a lot of people in business like to think of budgeting as a science, and it's not. It's really just not. It is basically, it's very educated guesswork. You can guess very well. You can talk to people who have done what you have done before. But remember, every book is different, every game is different, and every publisher is different. So I can ask 100 publishers what to expect in my budget, and if 100 publishers unilaterally tell me that it is going to cost me $5,000 to pro-publish this book, that doesn't matter. It's good to know, and anecdotal evidence can be valuable, but you can't bet the farm on it. You cannot assume that what is good for that publisher is good for you. It is something that you have to grow with as a publisher. Budgeting is very hard at first. It gets a little easier as you go, but there is no magic. There's no way to just mysteriously come up with those numbers and have them to be perfect. You have to understand your audience. Honestly, for money reasons, you have to understand your audience way better than for game reasons. Whenever you're making a game, whenever you're publishing a book, you can do everything in the world to make it awesome, and then whenever you bring it to the table, what they're doing is their table. They're bringing the table to the table. They're bringing their players to the table. If they like the game, it is partially because of the players. It is partially because of your game. You are never going to tell them, this is how you have to play it. It's not going to work that way. But, so you have to understand players. You have to understand your base. But you really have to understand them better for money. You have to understand how many there are, how invested they are, how many people they expect at a table to buy it. Another big myth is that you have some core audience, some people that buy games, and then, you know, they have friends at their table who don't buy games. They're not really the market. That, as far as I'm concerned, that's bullshit. Because everyone at that table is the end user. Some of them, some games that I've played in, everyone has the book at the table, whatever. Usually that's not the case. That's just the kind of games I play. But everyone is that end user, and you have to understand it. Even if they're not putting down their hard-earned money, they are still using the product. And they are just as valid a customer as the person who put down the money. Yeah.
With all the considerations regarding the $27 book you mentioned, mm-hmm. How do you make the business decision not to go black and white?
Well, funny you should mention that. I'm now testing my black and white options. Black and white is probably how I'm going to get it into traditional distribution for this particular product. Because $27 versus $6. $6 is a lot different than $27. And that $6 book I can put through traditional distribution. The problem is that if you don't budget for it up front, then you have all of the art layout is all in color. You have to basically redo it, or at least re-render it. So that's a whole different part of the process. And you have paid for the work, like you had the work done in color. So it's again, one of those things that you have to sort of assess as you go. In this case, in our particular case, which only helps so much, we are able to have both. We are able to have a color product and a black and white product, and they worked fine. This is why games will never be big, big business, because we have to match vision to product. This is not just something where we can maximize profits and say, this is going to make the most bang for our buck. No, I said, this game needs to be color. The things that we are doing need to be expressed as a full-color hardcover tome. It just deserves it. And ultimately, we will make less money because of that. But it's a better game for it. So it's a balancing act where artists.
Have you considered going ebook?
Oh, yeah, we definitely do ebooks. Actually, a PDF option is pretty much the place where we make most of our money. We don't make as much off of the print runs. Ebooks are big in RPGs.
Only going to get bigger.
Yes.
The rise of milk.
Absolutely. iPads are beautiful for PDFs on games, and we sell a lot of them. That's another option that's kind of cool with print-on-demand is that you can, like with DriveThruRPG, for example, you can do a digital version, and then you can also do an alternate version that is a print-on-demand version, so your customers can just go to the website, order it, it is print-to-made, and sent to them. It costs a little, it makes you a little bit less, but you don't have the same investment on a print run. But whenever you go to a convention, you can order a print run, but it's expensive. It's really expensive to do that. But it gives you the option, like your customers have that accessibility. And really, I think one thing about RPGs is it's a niche hobby. There's no central repository for everything. You cannot go to Walmart of RPGs. It just doesn't really exist. You have to put them in different I know, right? You have to put them in different places. You have to make them accessible in a million different ways, and many of those ways will make you less money. You cannot expect to say, I'm going to make $15 off of every copy, because you're going to have the distribution option where you make $3 off of the same copy. And it sucks, and it is what it is. But you have to understand that going in. If you want your game to be successful, if you want your game to be available, you have to take up an occasional bullet. Sucks. We are running towards the end, so I'm gonna try to address some questions because that's the process. That's the way that it works. That's some of the foibles that we've had. But I want to make sure that if you have any questions or curiosities, I can get them.
If your game has a custom made, they all kind of custom made rule sets.
Yeah.
What do you do to protect that intellectual property? Just someone else doesn't say that's a great system.
You don't. Copyright. It's actually impossible.
Yeah, no.
The only thing that you can do, copyright law. Okay, so copyright law is a really weird thing for games. If I make a game, a real estate trading game, that is set around a square board that has all of the properties of New Jersey, or of Atlantic City, New Jersey, on it. And the mechanic is that I roll two dice, I go around the board, whenever I land, I have the option to buy the property. If I choose to not buy the property, it goes to auction and all the other players can buy it. And the person who is last standing, who has not gone bankrupt, wins. I can do that. I'm absolutely allowed. If I call it Monopoly, I cannot do it. Words can be trademarked. As long as you express the rules in different words, they are not copyrighted. Fortunately, our hobby is pretty cool. Games are a pretty good environment. You don't really have a lot of people who are interested in ripping things off, even if they're really good. Because most people want to do their own thing. There are occasionally people who want to rip things off. And that's the beauty of games, actually. Every game that I've ever done, I was cribbing off of someone else.
Right.
I have some really unique shit out there, but there is nothing that I have done that has not been built on the backs of everyone since Gygax.
And he stole too.
Yeah. He was a confessed thief of intellectual property. There is an argument that unfortunately it is perfectly allowed within the scope of U.S. and most world copyright laws. There is also an argument that it makes better games. And that I am of a mind, personally, I make my games all under a Creative Commons licensing. I am of a mind that everyone should be able to take my stuff, bring it out there, and make something better with it. Because there's an investment. I ask for attribution. If you want to take my game, tear it apart, build something else based on it, and you just say the idea was based on something done by this person, then that helps build that community around my product. People are like, oh, crap, that was, X product by David Hill. I'm going to go to their website. I'm going to check it out. Sometimes people will actually buy from it. I've had people do modifications and hacks in my games, and other people have read them and then come back and bought my stuff. And that's awesome. we are a community. And for the most part, we are all in this for the love. There are very few exceptions to that. You will never really run into those people in publishing independently. If you ever work for, you know, Wizards or something like that, you will run into the occasional person who is not in it for the love. But for the most part, we all are. Game text is, on the other hand, it is copyright protected, and that is very, very simple. Copyright is a lot simpler than people make it out to be, and that if you do it, if you publish it, if it is extant and it is out there, it's protected. If you need to, if someone actually cribs your text, you can take them to court. You can take them to job. We get a lot of times people are like, oh yeah, copyright law, they're breaking the law. Actually, no. Copyright law is never really breaking the law. That's something that people don't necessarily understand. Copyright cases are all civil cases. And right now, if I wanted, I could take you to a copyright court. I could say that you're ripping off my shit. And my case is just as valid as like the RIAA. Because it's civil court. Civil court really is not law in the proper sense. It's not criminal law. If you run into a situation like that, you are the strict minority in games. Very rarely does that happen. It does happen. Very rare. And if it does, you take them to civil court. Fortunately, whenever people are ripping shit off of you, it's pretty obvious. And civil court will, as long as you can prove damages, you're good. And in RPGs, if you take someone to civil court and win because they ripped you off, that's controversy, and controversy sells games. So,
you can steal my game.
Yeah, right? Right? Yeah, well, that's a settlement.
I heard that it costs more to steal someone else's game than to come up with your own.
Oh, yeah.
Through legal fees and possible damages.
Oh, yeah. Well, possible damages is exactly 100% of what you made. That's a crock of shit. It's 100% on average. Usually it's more than that. A lot of times, like the RIAA says that if you copy a CD, you are liable for $7,000 per track. You paid a dollar for a CDR. Copyright laws is weird. It's very strange. Like, clearly I'm not a copyright lawyer, but I do pay very close attention to copyright law. Yeah, it's very, very expensive to steal people's shit on copyright laws.
What if your game is based on, like, a standard game? Like, you gave the example of Monopoly. No one owns, like, the copyright to chess or checkers or anything like that.
That's public domain.
Those are public domain.
Yeah, fair. Public domain, okay. Games are effectively public domain. You cannot copyright rules. You cannot patent rules. You can copyright text. So if you find the Parker Brothers version of chess that they printed and what have you, and you copy their text is protected.
Do WotC patent tapping cards?
Yes. That's not a rule though. Kind of. That's very complex how they got that to pass. But basically, they were patenting a specific method of a product behavior. Because tapping a card, the way that the patent is worded, because we had a huge kerfuffle about this, the way that the patent is worded is not the player's behavior of tapping the card, it is the fact that the card changes functionality when it is turned sideways. So it's just like if you turn over a car and it's on. The standard ignition in a car is patented. It's not because you can turn it. That is not the behavior is not what's important. It is the different function. So you can't have the mechanic where you turn the card sideways and it has different functionality. But, and you can't copy their rules text for that.
You can place a token on the card.
You can do a million different things with it. Yeah, yeah. That is a weird one, and that one has been often disputed, but that's the ultimate argument comes down to is the different functionality when the thing is in a different position. It has nothing to do with the game rules per se. It's a functionality issue. which is mechanic. Like, not mechanics like game mechanics, but mechanics like engineering mechanics. And yes, it's a crock of shit. that's the other thing about copyright law. Copyright law is, and patent law to a certain extent, is bullshit. It is whatever you can argue. It is very much a practice for people that are very well trained in rhetoric. That is why lawyers are copyright friendly. Like, that's why you need a lawyer if you want to bother with copyright that much. It's silly, but it is what it is. But anyway, if you have Milton Bradley chess, you find their chess, you cannot copy their text, you can still make chess. Games
are refer to like a standard set of rules, like base rules of the U.S. Chess Federation, or is that something?
I bet you they're copyrighted. I don't know, but I bet you their standard rules are. If you refer to them and you say page 64 in the U.S. Chess Foundation or whatever, that's fine. Reference is cool. That's fair use. But if you are actually copying their text, I bet you it's copywritten. I don't know for that specific anecdote. As long as you're not copying the text, but you're rewording it in a different way, you're safe. I've considered doing games based on stuff like that. And you can absolutely do it. You'll notice in media and games and stuff, you'll often see references to it. Like, you'll see reference to this is the way a knight moves, and that's how your, war machine would eat or whatever moves. You'll see reference to it. It's perfectly viable. Because you can't copyright game mechanics. You just can't do it. And that's why, if you pay attention, like, the dealer's hall is a good place to do this research. If you go out there, you'll find Monopoly for a million different things. Sometimes they are licensed. A lot of times they're not. Technically, there's an argument that they could be sued for using the Opoly ending, but that has also been, in a number of cases, ruled as fair use.
There's one game company that all they do is specialize in Opoly.
Yeah, like, you can do, like, Ohio State University Opoly.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely not licensed. And they're the instance in case where they were going to be sued. The case was thrown out because it was considered parody, which is covered under fair use.
And if I recall correctly, I believe the base rules
mm-hmm.
are actually public domain at this
mm-hmm.
point. For that,
Monopoly is actually a bad example.
And that's
Monopoly
why
is public domain.
Some of these can come out because everyone is referring to the base
yeah.
rules that were originally published in what, 1920s?
Something like that. Yeah, they are public domain. Copyright law is very weird. In U.S. copyright law specifically, because there's a joke in copyright circles that the length of time it takes for something to become public domain is the difference between the current year and the year of the release of Steamboat Willie plus two. Because every time the public domain laws start to
specifically rewrote it for.
Yeah, they've written it for Disney about six or seven times.
Disney ripped off everyone, and then they can't use Disney.
Yeah. So, but according to current copyright law, Mickey Mouse will become public domain very soon. So the Supreme Court will probably be like, no.
They can renew it. They can renew the copyright.
No, they can't, actually. They're not able to renew the copyright. What it is that Steamboat Willie will become public domain, but modern interpretations of Mickey will not. So, for example, you cannot do Epic Mickey. You can do Steamboat Willie Mickey. It's convoluted. But no, you can't actually renew it. What will happen is that the Supreme Court will rule that it is necessary for the American economy to keep Steamboat Willie out of the public domain. Oh yeah, but they've done it a number of times. Yeah,
I've been waiting to do a porn called Steamboat Willie.
I know, right? It's the marketing rights itself.
Every era builds on a generation before that. For
absolutely,
technology and stuff. But now we get this era where we can't.
Yeah,
because we.
And we're like the only ones that can't.
Right.
The rest of the world is not like this, for the most part. Most other nations have.
That's why they just lie to their heads off and
pirate
the whole thing.
Well, I think that part of that is that America is such a young nation. We don't really understand that they have 600-year-old properties out there.
They have real castles, not plastic.
Yeah.
You're robbing it. Nothing to do with the customer.
Yeah, nobody has ever sued people for robbing it, by the way. But Sherlock Holmes, how? That's a whole different story. So what time is it? How are we doing?
After 11.
Okay. Well, I'll let you guys go. If you are interested, I will be still around. I'm going to do another panel on game design, and we're actually going to make a game during the thing.
Is that RPG in an hour?
Yeah, it's fun.
World War II part,
yeah. Yes, so. That was interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was good stuff. And if you have the opportunity, come by our booth, 1356 in Dealers Hall. We have very, very fun games of all shapes and sizes, well, three shapes and sizes there. And we would love to see you. So come say hi to us. Machine Age Productions.
Oh, by the way, there's also a seminar, The Legal Rules of Gaming, in this building at 3 p.m., if you don't know.
There's also at 7 p.m., I believe. Protect yourself.
Okay.
It deals with copyright laws and such as well.
I do board games.
But that's
tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Patents
and trade.
Okay.
March.
Oh. Yeah. If you have the tickets, drop them off up here. I'm supposed to turn them in, but like they don't really care about it too much.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the free seminars. They're not.
They're not all the same. Cubicle 2, or sorry, Studio 2, Cubicle 7, they are print and distribution fulfillment. They will help people front their print runs and such. And they will help promote things. You have to put their label on your book. IPR is purely a distribution channel and a consignment shop. It is something with which you give them stuff, and they will give you money whenever it sells. That's a big difference there. I think that there's definitely a place for the sort of print and distribution fulfillment, the Cubicle 7s, the Studio 2s. It's definitely not for everyone.